did you end up spending 20 years in the SAS?
Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Somalia, Bosnia, Latin America, Middle East. Firing rockets at us while we was on the ground, dropped a bomb near us. The tension changed. Third World War could come about. Saddam Hussein was on the run, wasn't he?
Yep, yeah.
He ruled the Middle East. He was the big guy on the block with the biggest army. He had all the strength and all the power. I was actually with the media crew that actually found him. We were in the vehicles, this is Bravo 30, and we could see bombing going off in Baghdad. If we don't do something, a lot of innocent people are going to die.
Welcome to the Eventful Lives podcast. I'm your host Dodge and I'm the founder of Bournemouth Sevens, the world's largest sport and music festival. On this podcast, I speak to proper characters of all lived eventful lives. Do us a favour and hit that follow button and be sure to check us out on YouTube, Instagram, Facebook and TikTok at Dodge Woodall, where we've now had over 100 million views. Des Powell is an elite SAS legend and author of the number one best-selling book, Bravo 30. We discuss his brutal journey in the forces from selection to tours of Iraq and the Gulf War. We also delve into Des's time in the Parachute Regiment as a Sergeant Major, going in depth on his first-hand accounts of conflict and terror. This is the eventful life of Mr. Des Powell. Des, welcome to the show, mate.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me today.
Good. Very much looking forward to this one. Let's roll all the way back. Where did you grow up and how did you end up spending 20 years in the SAS?
I was born in Sheffield and I grew up in a place in Sheffield called Attercliffe Darnell. And everybody ever says to me, they always say, oh, that's a rough place in Sheffield. But you know, something, Dodge, you know, wherever you come from, you don't see it like that, do you? But I know how people look at Sheffield because it's always had this reputation, this kind of hard reputation. It's the steel city. And I always used to feel proud of it because steel was always exported all the way around the world. And on my travels, wherever I used to go, I used to say, pick up your knife and forks. I can guarantee you there's Sheffield printed on here, you know. Yeah, so I was always proud of Sheffield, you know. And but these inner cities are rough, aren't they?
Very, yeah.
And I think coming up through my school days, I think my family did a good job. I think it's so easy to go to the dark side, isn't it? And my mum did a really good job. I think a lot of people, when they hear about you being in the military, especially in the SAS, they seem to think that you're like one of these American rappers. You've been shot about four times and you've come from the hood and you've been in prison and what have you. Yeah, for me, I come from a really good family. They love me to bits and they kept me on the straight and narrow and I can thank my mum and dad for that.
Yeah, big shout out to your mum and dad for that.
Yeah.
What was the moment in your time as a teenager where you thought, you know what, I want to go into the military?
I suppose I left school at 15 and that's a ridiculous age to leave in. It's, you know, I knew nothing and I realised I'd wasted my time. I mean, I had problems reading and writing, but at that time, people used to say, you'd be good in the military. I used to say, get lost, I'm not going in the military. I'm not going to have people shout at me and tell me what to do and what have you. But I used to think, I don't know, maybe in the future I might want to join. But what was in my mind at that time was I wanted to do something that had something to do with steel again, that I just mentioned, the steel city, and I fancied working in the steelworks. At that time when you left Skoyle, it was go down the pit, okay, the coal were on at that time. And all going the steelworks. And the first job I had, my mum got at me, and I used to stack shelves in a supermarket and mop the floors. The second job, my mum got me a job being a butcher. I thought, I quite like that. And then the third job I liked, you know, I was about 16 and a half. And I went in the steelworks and I was an hammer driver. And what an hammer driver is, it's like this big kind of construction, like a big ingot that goes up and down and it bashes these big hot ingots and it makes them into big iron girders, which can build buildings or smaller things, even as small as knife and forks, you know. But from there, it was always in my mind thinking, in the future, I might want to join the military. So I think the plant was seeded when I left school at 15. But I'd got this idea in my mind that I thought, you know, I'm going to do what everybody else does because it's kind of in your DNA. I'm going to go and join the steelworks or go down the pit and do that. And that's what I thought I was going to do. But obviously, out there, the universe had got other ideas for me, you know.
What age were you when you went into the military?
I was 19, but I had my 20th birthday going through training. In fact, what really put me, an image, if you like, of the military, I come down this part of the world, down to Bournemouth. My mum got a newsagent's business in Sheffield. Come and got a newsagent business in Bournemouth. And I come and work down here. And I worked as an odd carrier on the building sites. And I went down pool and I was sat there one day helping these bricklayers. You know, I used to knock up cement and carry the bricks and stuff like that. And I sat there having sandwiches. And all of a sudden out in the sea, I saw the old ribs, you know, like that, you know. And I'm looking on. I said to a mate of mine, what's that? He says, oh, they're the Marines. And I thought, ooh, that looks all right. I fancy a bit of that, like, you know. And so the first time I saw anything to do with military was down here.
Yeah.
And then when I went back up north, I went to the careers office and I was very cagey. That was about 19, you know. And I said, look, can I just have a chat about the military? And I come in and he said, come in and sit down. You know, what do you want to do? I says, well, I've seen these Marines down south. I thought, that looks right good. And he says, okay, come and sit in. And he said, do you want to take a test? And I thought, oh, you know, I don't fancy that. But I took a test and I failed it, you know. And I went away, thought about it. And he said, look, you can come back, take the test again. I think it was 6 months later. But why don't you think about joining the army? Because I think that you want to join the military straight away. I can see it in you. But I was scared to death. I thought, you know, so I had to go away and think about it. But at 19, I went back to the Army Careers Office, had a chat with the representative of the Army, which was a staff sergeant, and I took a test and I passed it. And we started talking and he said, do you know what you'd be good at? He says, why don't you join the paras? I says to him, don't they jump out in airplanes? I says, that sounds a bit scary. He says, by the time you get to jumping out of airplanes after 6 months, he says, you know, you'll be all right, like, you know. And and I thought, oh, you know. I says, oh, are they the best? He goes, they're the best you get. Yeah. He says, there may be someone better than that. And he says, I says, who are them? He says, a bunch of guys called the SAS. And I said, oh, who are them? Can I join them? He goes, no. He says, you can't join them until you've done a few years. I'm pointing it out because that was the first time I'd heard them three letters, SAS.
Wow.
And it's funny, it's... it kind of interested me straight away. It's the way he said it.
Yeah.
And them three letters sounded special anyhow, you know. Yeah. And the seed was kind of sown, sort of thing.
Wow.
And I passed the test and he said, go home, have a chat with your mum and dad. He says, you can sign for 3, 6, or 9 years. And so I went back to see my mum and I said, hey, I could join the paras if I want to. Of course, my mum said, oh, yeah, great bunch of guys, military, yeah, this, that, and the other. I come back the next day and signed on for 9 years. And the only reason I signed on for 9 years because it was to do with money. 3 years a week, you got £33. I think if you sign up for 6, you got £36. Sign up for 9 years, I got £39 or whatever. Yeah. So I says, I'll tell you what, I'll sign up for 9 years. Yeah. I'll sign up for the paras. And I thought, yeah, that'll do for me, like, you know.
What rough year are we talking here when you signed up for the paras?
I signed up, that was 77.
77,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
And what have you noticed over the years from when the paras, when you signed up to what they were then to what they are now?
I suppose the main thing that I see is that there's just, they're more organised. There's just a lot more information now. My eldest son, he's actually starting training next year. He's following in my footsteps. He's joining paras. And he was just telling me the only the other week, he says about how they know a lot more about fitness. They know a lot more about not injuring you. For example, the equipment in my day were a lot more basic. Used to get knocked about a lot. So you'd injure your joints, you'd injure your back, you'd have bad knees, et cetera, et cetera. And he was telling me that they're very much aware of injuries now. Mm. They're carrying body armor. So they they know more about strength training. In my day, it was just, you know, if you can't do it on beer and fags, you can't do it, you know. And so the
Is that right?
They used to say that. I remember, you know, when you know what it's like, Dodge. It's that stoic type mindset, which was back
are you
then.
Hard as nails, you can get in. There but there wasn't go. As much infrastructure in place, I guess.
That's right. If you can't drink 10 pints and eat, and you can't, you know, you know, full pack of Woodbine. And, you know, if you can't run over the hills, you know, with £50 on your back, you're just not it.
Okay. But
they're a lot more organized now. They just know far more information about the body, the way it responds, and what it does. So I think the organization is just better now, more info now, you know.
And how long, you said you signed up for 9 years. How long were you in the paras for before you said, right, I want a piece of the SAS. What have I got to do there to get into it?
Yeah, what I did 8 years. And what it was, Dodge, through them 8 years, I didn't see it as that I was going to have it as a career. I thought, I'll get out after 9 years. So what I did, I just took loads of courses, and one of the main courses I took was a physical training course. I become a PTI, physical training instructor within the paras. And I really enjoyed that. That was training the guys, checking them on runs, checking them fitness and stuff like that. I did other stuff, like I took my class 1, 2, and 3, heavy goods driving. I took as many courses as I could. But what happened is that I think a phrase that we use in the paras, we start to grow up. And I started to think, well, do you know something? If I do stay in, I don't think I could see myself doing, let's say, another 14 years, because you do 22 years, you do normally as a pensional type.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's what you've got to do in the military. And I thought to myself, do you know something? If I'm going to take this seriously, I don't think I want to stay in the paras. I want to do something else. So two things I thought about. I could go in the PT Corps because I'd already got this physical training type fitness under my belt, and I liked it, I enjoyed it. But I thought, if I'm going to go the soldiering route, there's only really one route you can go, and that's go to the SES. And what it was, answering your question, Dodge, is that I think I'm always a slow burner. I was a reluctant soldier, you know. And guys used to say to me, you know, Des, why don't you go up to the SES? And I used to go, oh, I don't fancy that. They're a bunch of weirdos, them. You know, you did all these, they're strange, them guys. You know, you don't see them like, you know, and, you know, there's all sorts of rumors about them, you know, they do work that you don't know about. And, they're assassins, and they do all sorts of stuff, you know, crazy stuff. And, but what it was one day, I saw this guy in camp, and he just looked different. You know, everything about him, his uniform, the way he looked, the way he talked. And I saw the people around him treating him different. And I said to me, man, I says, who's that guy over there? And he says, you know, SAS, Special Air Service. And again, even though I'd heard about him being in battalion, that was the first time I'd seen one. He just looked different. Everything about him, he just looked really casual. His hair was longer. He looked fitter. He didn't salute the officers. He was just relaxed in everything he did. And I thought, that looks all right. That's different. I fancy some of that. And then what happened then is one of my friends, you know, started to say, you know, that's the sort of guy I think, you know, you want to become in the future, Des. He says, I think that would kind of suit you. And what it was, a friend said, Des, I'm going to go and see a friend that's up at Hereford, because I'm thinking of joining the SES. Why don't you come with me and have a chat with me, with him, like, you know? And I thought, okay, I'll just go along and have a chat. And we got chatting with him, and he actually said to me, have you thought of coming up to Hereford and what have you? I said, no, I says, I don't fancy it, you know. But each time I kind of come in contact, the exposure, if you like, of seeing an SES guy, or hearing about it, I just got more and more interested. So I thought to myself, I don't think going to the PT Corps is a good one. It just weren't in me. I was kind of going through the motions, Dodge, you know what I mean? I like the physical side. Yeah. I like the PT and what have you, but I didn't see it as a career. So I thought, if I'm going to sign on again, you know, where I'm going to go is go to Hereford. But it's them two fears, isn't it, Dodge? It's that fear, am I good enough? Or what if I fail? And I was talking myself out every time. I don't think I'm experienced enough. I don't think I'm good enough. And you hear all these rumors about, you know, it's 90% failure rate. You know, when guys went for it, you had to wait for guys to fail to come back so you could talk to them like this and say, right, how did you get on? How far did you go? You know, what's it like? Is it hard? Is it this? So you had to wait for guys to fail before they come back. And the guys that went and passed, they never come back.
Yeah.
You never saw them again. So there was this kind of, secretive type, you know, feeling around the regiment that you couldn't get any information, even if you wanted to. And so that made it even more kind of, I don't think I can do it. So I was just talking myself out of it.
Yeah.
When I felt I was fit enough, I was probably fit enough for Dodge, but I don't think my mind had matured up enough. And I think I had to wait right up until like the eighth year. I'd done 8 years in Parareg. And then that's when I kind of volunteered, because I thought, well, the next year I'm going to get out anyhow, because I'd signed up for 9 years. And what I did, it's a volunteer basis. I volunteered. And
you volunteered for what?
Yeah, for the SAS.
Okay, so you volunteer and say, I fancy this.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you have to put pen to paper and you have to go and see the adjutant. And, and that's what I did. I said, look, I fancy going for, they call it selection. And he said, yeah, okay. The problem with that is that I'd got a posting down to depot. Depot is where you come through training to do the paras. And I'd got a good posting, a posting to be an instructor as a PTI down at Parachute Regiment in Aldershot. Okay, the depot, we call it. And he said, well, look, he said, you've got a posting there. He says, can I advise you? He says, go down to depot, do your 2 years, get more experience. And he says, depot is a good springboard for you to go forward then, he says, on selection. He says, you'll have more exposure. He says, you see the guys. He says, they were coming back. He says, because they tend to go to depot, then go off to selection, come back or whatever training. And I thought, yeah, that's a good idea.
So you're wanting to get information off people before properly committing.
Yeah.
Right, okay, I get it. Yeah.
And do you know what, Dodge? You just couldn't get it.
Yeah.
Guys would come back and it's the usual thing, what's it like? Oh, yeah, it's not too bad. It's not this, it's not that. But they'd failed, you know. And I go, right, what was it like? How far did you go? What was it like in the jungle? Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, you can't do, or it's this and that and the other. I couldn't find anybody that really sit down and tell me the truth, you know, and especially guys that had gone up there. I thought, well, I need to get some of my mates who's gone up there. Of course, they'd never come back.
Yeah.
And then one day, there was a guy that come and knocked on my bunk in camp. And I didn't know him. And he said, Des, I've heard you're thinking about selection. I goes, yeah. He says, come round to our house tomorrow night. And he says, I'll tell you all about it. He says, because I've just come off it, like,
happy days.
Yeah. And
but that was a game changer for you, wasn't it?
Well, what it was, I got someone, Dodge, that spoke the truth to me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I went, he's a married guy in pads, and I went down. He goes, right, sit down, Des. He goes, look, I'll tell you exactly as it is. He says, I know what guys are like. They won't tell you it's hard. And he sat down and he says, it's the hardest thing I've ever done. He says, I reached the jungle phase, and he says, what I've got here, he goes, look, I've got some equipment. I've got a little diary. He says, he gives you every step of the way. And he says, I'm plus tonight. He says, I'll brief you. And he says, and, you know, after you, we'll have a cup of tea. And he says, and after I brief you, he says, you'll go away. And he says, you'll have all the information I think you need. I says, what about you? Are you thinking of going back? Because you have two guzzers, you know? Yeah. He says, yeah, I am, and I'm going to give you a rest. And I had a feeling it weren't, because he gave me his boots, his equipment, his diary and everything. But he briefed me solid. He said, this is as it is. And he told me how hard it was, how tough, what to expect, how to prepare, you know, the lot. And this is what equipment you need. And by the way, prepare for this, do that, do the other.
So just for the listeners out there, we're talking in mid-80s here.
Yes.
Late 80s.
Yeah.
There was no internet. There was no information. There's no mobiles. There's no social media. No one could pass anything on. Yeah. No SAS were speaking about anything.
Yeah.
No paratroopers were speaking about anything.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That is that the only information you could get is word of mouth.
Yes.
And paras being paras, they won't come back and saying it's the hardest thing I've ever done.
Yeah.
Oh, well, it's this. Oh, it's not too bad and what have you. But this guy was truthful. I thought, right, this is what I want. And Dodge, I was in the right place.
Yeah.
I was at depot. And the good thing about depot, you've got all the instructors there as far as weapon training, map reading, getting fit, getting all the information you want as preparation for going up there. So what I did my 2 years instruction of being an instructor as a PTI dandy. In other words, working in the gym, checking the young paratroopers through. And I really enjoyed that. You know, enjoyed, as I call it, putting water back in the well, you know.
Yeah.
And I was able then to kind of prepare myself, fitness, weapon-wise, map reading-wise, all the practical skills that a soldier needs. What I did, I was just brushing up. But I'd been out soldiering for a while because I'd been following the PT route. So I thought, right, I really need to take this serious. And so that's what I did. And also, the guys that were still kind of filtering through Depot, I was able to still get more information, yeah. up-to-date information. Yeah. And I'm mentioning that because there were three guys that failed, actually came back to Depot and said, Des, do you want to come back up on the hills with us? We'll set you up on the Brecon Beacons.
Brilliant.
We'll show you roughly this, that, and the other. Yeah. I thought, right, that's a good deal. But what I had to do, I had to wait for the 2 years at Depot. Then the paras don't give you any time off. You've got to do it all in your own time. So me and the other three guys, we went up to a camp up in Wales. I had a chat with a sergeant major at one of these camps and says, look, we're going to do selection. Could we come up here over the next 6 to 8 weeks? We're going to be walking up on the hills. And he says, yeah, you can have them bunks over there. Crack on. So we had to take our own leave, do it in our own time. Mm. And we actually went up onto the beacons and actually just practiced walking on the hills, map reading, and just generally getting the savviness, if you like, of being up where the SAS train sort of thing, which is mainly the Brecon Beacons. Mm. Like, you know.
Amazing. So you started at the age of 19. You did 8 years in the parish. You did 2 years at Depot. What age do you think you were at those 10 years when you actually became when you thought, well, I'm a real man right now? Because yeah, you're going at 19, you're still a boy really, right?
Yeah, you are. Yeah. You know, I mean, I put pen to paper 19. I had my 20th birthday going through training in Parachute Regiment.
Yeah.
Okay. So I had 8 years in, so I was 28 by the time I passed selection and then went up to Hereford. And yeah, there was this thing where you feel you're a man. I was fit enough, I think, for most things. I mean, all paratroopers are fit guys, you know. And I was in the right place, Dodge, because I think the parachute regiments have more exposure to the SES. It's like a sister regiment.
Yeah.
We're airborne. It's the airborne brotherhood. Yeah. And that's no disrespect to any other regiment because, as you know, the SES is made up of all regiments within the British Armed Forces. But the parachute regiment, okay, has more exposure. Even though we didn't know very much, as I explained. And in fact, even today, 50% of the regiment is made up of paratroopers. And that's mainly because of the Airborne Brotherhood.
Mm.
The training is similar. And we have more exposure, okay, to the regiment itself.
Mm.
Answering your question, body-wise, I felt I was strong enough, fit enough, ugly enough, fast enough as a man. But mentally, when I look back, if I'd have gone any earlier, if I'd have gone at 25, 26, I finished up going in at 28, I found I was mature enough to deal with selection itself. And I think a lot of guys don't get that. They go up and go, well, I'm good. I can carry the weight. I'm good at map reading. I'm a good soldier. But I call it growing up. There's this mentality that you've got to have. And I think we're talking about it. Now people talk about it all the time, this SF mindset, this special forces mindset, this strength of mind. And I think it's actually maturing. It's actually growing up. It's actually knowing, I'm savvy enough. I'm streetwise enough. Yes, I'm fit enough. Yes, I feel I'm a good enough soldier, but am I mature enough to deal with this sort of stress? Mm.
What was it like for you when you actually put pen to paper and said, right, I want to do selection now?
Yeah.
That moment you said, right, I want to do it, and now I'm in Wales, and then I'm going to the jungle. What was that like, that whole period?
Yeah, it's two times you put pen to paper. It's one when you first sign up and you say, I vow to fight for Queen and country at that time. And then the second time I signed is, as you said, is when I signed for selection.
Mm.
And I remember being called up to the office, to the adjutant's office, and saying, right, Des, you can go off and you can, join the regiment, but you've got to sign here. I remember looking at it and pausing for a while because I can't remember exactly what it says, but it said something about you're now entering the Special Air Service Regiment, and you are now going on permanent active service. Okay, and there was more to it, and I kind of paused and I was looking at it. And I remember the adjutant kind of looking at me and said, are you okay? And I said, no, I'm fine. And I quickly signed it. Mm. And what I was doing at that time, I remember, I just looking and thinking, I know my life's going to change as soon as I sign this. And I kind of had no doubt that I was going to pass, which sounds quite big-headed.
Mm.
But I thought to myself, I'm going to fully commit to this. and I'm going to do everything I possibly can, you know. And I'm thinking, if everything goes the way I visualized, this is going to be life-changing. This is going to be an amazing life, you know. And I remember signing it, smiling at him. And that was it. I then started my training.
How long did it take from start to finish to actually pass the SAS?
Yes. So just to set the scene, I'd joined. I'd done 8 years para reg. Within that 8 years, I'd done 2 years down at depot. I started that preparation down there, and then the selection itself is a 6 month period. Mm. Okay, and I did two selections. I failed the first one. And
how did you fail?
Yeah, I got through to the jungle. And we do some drills in the jungle, which are called contact drills. And it's actually firing at an imaginary enemy out there, and you have to kind of pepper pop back. And the drills is where you're firing at the target or the enemy. You pepper pop back in twos and fours. And as I'm rushing through and I started to go through some bush, I felt something grab hold of my wrist. And it kind of wrapped. There's this thing called wait a while, and what it does, it sticks into your clothing, into your flesh, and you have to stop, wait a while, undo it, and then carry on. Mm. Well, these drills, I was kind of running through the foliage, if you like, and a large thorn went through my wrist, and the medic actually come and had a look and said, that's quite serious. It needs to be casivac'd out. And I hadn't done enough within the jungle. Within the jungle phase is about 4 to 5 weeks. And I got halfway through and I got this injury on my wrist, and they had to casivac me out and send me to an hospital out in Brunei. And they won't let me come back in the jungle. And where that seems unfair, they just see it as a fail. You know, you failed. So I had to wait until everybody had finished the jungle phase. We'll come back to UK. You have to go through. Right, sorry about that. We've got another one that you can do. You can come back on the second one.
Did you have to do the Welsh part of that, the second one, as well as the jungle?
You've got to do it
the whole
again. All again. All again. And people said to me, they go, so did you find, what was the hardest one, the first one or the second one? I guess it's got to be the second one because you know what's coming.
You know what's coming, yeah.
You know exactly what's coming. And you know something, Dodge, what they do is that, the you know, you sat in front of the major like this, you go, right, there's unlucky, you know, you got injured and... but you can come back again, you know, your second one. And he says, tell you what, give it a year's rest and come back. And I said, look, boss, I says, I've got to come straight back. I says, if I go back to para reg, I'm going to lose momentum. Yeah. By the way, I've got less than a year to go before I get out. And I know I won't come back. Can I have permission to come straight back? And what that means is that I'd just done the winter one. Mm. You then go away. The one that is going to start is the summer one. Mm. So that's another 6 months. So I you know, use that. And then I have to start the following winter. So it's like 18 months all in all by the time you're finished. So when you do selection back to back, it's an 18-month process. And he looked at me and said, are you sure about that? I goes, yeah. I says, that's what I want to do. So he goes, okay. And he says, that's what you want. And they write it up and, you know, and luckily, this major that was there, he used to be in para reg as well. And he used to be one of my officers when I was. So he knew me and he knew what type of guy I were. Mm. And I think that helped me. Not that he could do anything to help me get through. He just knew that I was a determined type of individual. Mm. And he, you know, kind of go, okay, yeah, you know. And so what he did, signed it on. I had to go back to para reg. And it's funny, Dodge, when you get serious, our things kind of slot into place for you, don't you? Mm. And I went back and I went back and saw a sergeant major that I know back in para reg. And he says, unlucky Des, you know, he says, tell you what, come back to para reg, get stuck into things, you know, and crack on. And he says, you can go back and do selection in another year. And I knew this sergeant major, I knew him when he was a staff sergeant. And he's passed away now, a really nice guy.
What's his name?
His name is Kev Whittle. Okay, well, Kev Whittle, passed away. May he rest in peace, a good guy. Yeah, yeah. And this is what I mean about things slotting into place. He knew me as well.
Yeah.
As I say, he knew me when he was a staff sergeant. All of a sudden, I go back. I go, why is it sergeant major? And he's a sergeant major of my company. Mm. So I went back and I says, just let in does. Everything will work and you can go back on selection a year ago. I goes, look, Kev, I need a favour. I goes, I need to go straight back. And he says, and he's kind of looking at me, he says, what do you mean? I go, look, I've got less than a year before I get out anyhow. He goes, yeah, you can sign back on again, no problems. Mm. And I says, no, I says, I need to go straight back. I goes, you know what it's like. I says, I've got this inside me. I've got to go and do it. Yeah. If I lose momentum, I said, I'll finish up not going. And I says, and to be truthful, Kev, you know, I'm burning bridges here. If I fail selection, I'm going to get out. I'm going to go into Civvy Street. And I could see him kind of look at me like that. And he kind of, you know, and he went, okay, then I get you. Now, he could have, if it'd been someone else, he could have gone, no, you're back in. We need you back here. Yeah. We need guys, et cetera, et cetera. I would have said, firstly, if I'd done the right thing, I would have signed on, but I would have lost momentum. I would have probably got out. And what I mean about that is when you get serious about something, Dodge, all of a sudden, you know, we can call it, you know, the universe or whatever. It's like it's saying, are you serious about this? You know, and people tend to slot into
place. Falls into place, yeah, doesn't it? Yeah, agree.
People, places, opportunities. Yeah. It just all seemed to happen. That major said, okay, yeah, come back on the next one.
Yeah.
Kev Whittle could have said, no, you've got it. He said, yeah, okay, like, you know. And what it was me saying, hang on, I'm serious about this. Mm. I want this. This is what I want. And even though I was unlucky in the jungle, I thought, oh, you know I can do this.
How frustrated were you on that first hit when you were in the jungle, got taken to hospital, all the boys were carrying on, a lot of them passed, a lot of them failed, but you got sent home and gone, I've actually failed because I got injured.
Well, let me tell you, a story there is that come back, and I had to wait and come back with other guys coming back from Brunei.
Yeah.
And by the way, there was about 40 guys.
Yeah.
And you can understand now that I'm upset, like, you know, and it comes back and I'm packing my kit and I hadn't seen the major yet. And one of the guys said something to me and I flashed, you know, I said, hey, you know, and he goes, hey, sour grapes, does, you know, you didn't get in, you know, you weren't good enough sketch and whatever. Yeah. We had a bit of a fracas, you know, and sort of some punches thrown and what have you. And I thought, oh, this is going to be, you know, this is not good for me. You can't do this on selection. You can't go bashing people. Mm. And when I saw the major before I left, when he said, yeah, you can come back. I then said, I just need to tell you something that, by the way, I've just had a drying room session. And the drying room session means that in the paras, if you have any fracas with anybody, we've got, let's get in the drying room.
And have a tear up.
And have a tear up, as you put it. Yeah. So that's what we did, like, you know. And I had to say that to the major, if you like, of training squadron SAS. And he goes, what do you mean you had a drying room? And I told him the story. I goes, look, my fault. I was just upset that I, you know, failed selection. I put everything on, you know, I burnt my bridges and what have you. Mm. And he kind of looked at me and went, yeah, okay, no bad. And he kind of did, kind of shrugged his shoulders and go, okay.
When you passed selection, where was your first tour? As one of the elite of the elite, of the 1% of the 1% in the SAS, where was your first ever tour?
Okay, let me tell you, probably answering that is better to say the first thing I did with the regiment, which is like a tour.
Yeah.
The first thing I did with the regiment, which worked very, very well for me, is that out of the guys that passed selection, is that two of us went to B Squadron. Okay, B Squadron at that time were the squadron that had done the Iranian embassy siege.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. So
down in Brighton?
So they were the ones. And so we went there, and the very first day that I joined the regiment is that day was the day that the regiment formed up in the SAS, is that you've got guys all over the world.
Yeah.
But there's certain times in the regiment they've got to do certain things. And this one is the 6-month tour of the anti-terrorist team. So the squadron has to come back, and for 6 months, that's their job.
Wow.
Okay, anti-terrorist team. So day one,
I joined
straight in. And that was good for me because I got to know everybody.
Yeah.
Okay. And you're doing the thing that you've got in your mind. You go, that's what I want to do in the SAS. All of a sudden, the black kit on. And the very first day, answering your question, Dodge, is that they said, right, you're two down to such and such training area, and just meet up with Sergeant so-and-so, and he'll tell you what to do. So the squadron's there, all in black. we turns up, you can imagine two new guys, not knowing anything, you know, all of a sudden this chopper comes in, a big Chinook, the big double-bladed ones, lands in front of us. All of a sudden, all the guys just get on. We look at each other, get on with them, and it starts, takes off and starts flying around the training area. Nobody tells us what we're doing. You know, we just get on with, you know, there's 30 guys on the aircraft. And suddenly, you know, one guy nudges me at the side of me and says, right, put these gloves on. And we put these big yellow gloves on. And we're in, you know, the black overalls and gas mask and stuff and what have you. He says, right, he says, when the aircraft comes to a hover, stops, he says, go out that door, just slide down the rope. Just grab it as tight as you can and slide down. I'd never done that before. You know, nobody showed me how to do it. They call it fast roping.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of a sudden, you know, you're going around in this chopper and it's going all over the place. All of a sudden, it comes to a hover like that. You know, they chuck the rope out and I see guys grabbing it and sliding down, I jumps in, slide down. And there's just a big pile of guys on the floor. We're all falling on each other. And then the chopper pulls away. Everybody starts laughing.
Yeah.
You know, they're laughing and giggling and stuff like that. And you're looking around and thinking, you know, is this the SAS or what have you? And the guy who was sat next to me told me about the gloves. He come over to me, says, new guys? I go, yeah. He goes, what's your name? I says, Des Powell. Put his hand out. He says, Andy McNabb. He says, yeah. He says, nice to have you aboard, like, you know. And I'm thinking, wow, this is great. And of course, for 6 months, you do all the black kit.
Amazing.
And I got to know everybody straight away. Yeah. The squadron were together. You did a black kit, so you're doing all the things you can imagine. So really, that was the first tour, if you like, was on the anti-terrorist team.
Amazing.
You
know? When you're in there like that, is it like, of course it is, it's like being in a rugby team, you've got brotherhood. You know you're looking around, you know he's got your back, he's got your back, he's got your back. How long did it take to get that sort of belief that everyone's got your back in once you get into the SAS?
Yeah, it's great. Answering your question, probably the best way I can put it like this is that suddenly you realize you're with a high echelon bunch of guys.
Yeah.
For example, is that there were guys that had rode part of the Atlantic Ocean, these guys that have climbed Everest. Mm. These guys that are doing free fall records. There were guys that had been on an Arabic course for 18 months.
Been on
an Arabic course.
Course, okay.
Yeah, learning Arabic. Wow. You know, another one learning Russian.
Wow.
And another guy had been out to Bavaria and been on a mountain leaders course for 18 months.
Right, okay.
You know, and you're looking around and all these people are at a very high level. Yeah. And you're going, wow. And this positivity and the camaraderie, if you like, it just kind of pulls you along.
Yeah.
And what I liked about it is that they want you to be the best you possibly can. Mm. They won't hold you down. They want you to do the best you can, to be the best. Like there was a guy who'd done a medical course. Yeah, yeah. And on the medical course, he felt he was that good that his wife was pregnant and she went into labor and delivered a baby.
Right.
You know, and you're hearing stories like this all the time. And what you do, you realize, you go, wow, I'm in the
this
right
is
place.
The 1% of the 1%. Did you ever have the feeling that you got imposter syndrome at all? We never know what imposter syndrome. It's only been a posh word for the last couple of years, isn't it?
But
are you saying, when you were ever there, were you looking around going, am I good enough to be in here? Because everyone would be thinking the same.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. For example, look, the way I look at it, and even today, I left school at 15.
Yeah.
I could hardly read and write.
Yeah.
You know, and after 28 years in the military, 8 in Parareg, 20 in the regiment, you know, is that you've traveled the world, you've been involved in just about every modern conflict since the Falklands. You do medical courses, languages, you're speaking with royalty, you are speaking with politicians, you are doing VIP protection around the world, and you are doing entry skills like free falling, driving across the deserts. You've got boat troop that are coming out in submarines. You've got mountain troop, which are climbing mountains. And you are then learning Morse code. You're learning medics. You're learning demolitions. You are learning languages. And you have to pinch yourself.
Yeah.
You just go, wow, what has happened here? Yeah. You go, and even today when people, then sometimes I get that fear. And I go, oh, I don't know whether I can do that. I don't. And you go, stop.
Yeah.
Stop. I've done that. I've done that. But I still feel it today.
Yeah.
It's, and I think that's a good thing. I don't know what you think, Dodge.
Yeah, it's that nervous feeling, isn't
it? Yeah, it is.
I enjoy that. I love having imposter syndrome. Yeah. You know you can't do something, but go, what's the space? I'm going to do it.
Yeah. And you know what is that when we've done talks around the country and, you know, and I talk to people, especially some of the youngsters that come up and go, I'm thinking I'm joining the forces and what have you. How did you go about it? And I hear them, I can even say, but I'm scared to do this and what have you. And I said 15 and I just explained a story about I couldn't read and write and I had problems, you know. And I think little old me that come from Sheffield, fearing everything, if you like, you know, where I'm in the steelworks, you know, and I'm looking around and I'm thinking, do you know something? I can see how my life's going to unfold with what everybody else does. He's boy meets girl, boy and girl get married, boy and girl
job,
have kids.
Pension,
and
then, dead.
Yeah. And we're these... To be truthful, nothing wrong with that. Yeah. You know, it happens to a lot. It's just that I didn't want that.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure what I wanted, Dodge. Mm. I just knew what I didn't want. And I just thought to myself, I want to do something different. And in my mind, I just thought, do you know, I fancy traveling and whatever. I didn't realize it was going to be the armed forces that were in a way were going to educate me. And if you like, indoctrinate me in a positive way, if you like.
Do you remember how much you got paid being in the SAS? Back in, what's this, 91, is it? Or 1990?
I you know, I can't remember the exact wage, but what I do remember is this, answering your question, is that you go up there and you have, you keep your normal wage of para-reg. I think I was a corporal then, when I went up.
Which is a yearly salary of roughly?
Yes.
We're talking 30 years ago here, aren't we?
Yeah, we are less, I don't know, 25 grand, so maybe less than that. Okay. Yeah. And then what happens is that you go up to the regiment and you're on that same wage for 2 years. Then all of a sudden it jumps up to a captain's wage. Mm. I can't remember how much it was at that time, but all of a sudden you look at your wage and you go, wow.
Happy days.
You know, like that. I remember being up at Stirling Lines, which is the old camp, which is not there anymore. Mm. And I went to the pay office and I says, I think there might have been a mistake. And he said, Des, how long have you been in now? And I says, oh, yeah, such and such. They go, no, that's your wage now. Brilliant. It's going to, and by the way, here's some more money because you're going away on a trip. And what I mean by that is that I remember going over to Latin America and going down to Africa and whatnot. And every so often, they pay you some money. And I go, what's that for? And they go, well, you're going on a trip soon and there's some money for you to buy this and buy a ticket or whatever. Yeah. And I go, oh. And I go, don't you do that. No, you're doing it. You know, there's not many of you going down. You're going to buy your own ticket and you're going to do this and that and the other. Everything was strange. It's hard to explain as far as that. In the normal military, like in the paras, everything's regimented and you do as you're told and this is what you do and you tend to do it collectively. As soon as you get to the regiment, you talk to everybody, first names. Yeah. It's not like sergeant, everything. You talk to the officers, his boss. You just discuss things like this. You work in very small teams, you know, no bigger than eights, you know, sixes, fours, sometimes in twos. These things that you'll go off and do by yourself in that country, this country. Mm. And it's very grown up. And that's what I liked about it. It really suited me.
If you were back in Sheffield
between
1990 and 2010, roughly, because you did 20 years, right?
Yeah.
When they're back in Sheffield and someone said, what do you do for a living? What were you used to say?
Oh, yeah. I used to say something really silly like, I'm into insurance, you know. Yeah, and I don't know about it. Oh, yeah, you know. Or even recently, a joke, and I said, oh, yeah, I'm into IT. Well, you know, my mate Paul will tell you I'm not very good on IT or whatever, you know. And and one of the reasons for that is that a lot of the time, I used to say I was still military, but I was back in Para Reg. And because I knew a lot of people that knew I had the physical training side, I still used to say I was a PT instructor in Para Reg.
Yeah, okay.
You know, I used to
And people wouldn't that. Know that you were the cut above.
Correct. Okay. Yeah, because I still used to come and go.
Yeah.
Still traveling and you've got a suntan every so often. Yeah. And so you've got to stick with a cover story that sounds, you know
were
realistic.
You married? Did you have a missus while you were in the SAS?
Yes. And I'm divorced now.
Are you divorced?
And yeah.
Well, when you left the SAS or when you were in there?
Yes, no, when we left. And looking back on it, a lot of it did have to do with the regiment. I mean, when we were saying, I remember the There was a statistic come out that said that the regiment had the largest divorce rate in the armed forces. Mm. And I can see why that were. We're away all the time.
What made your relationship not work? Did you change as a person, or did you have to keep secrets away from your missus, or would you tell your missus everything?
I think it's quite a few of them put together. Yeah. I think for a start, there's the worry that when you're going away, is that your other half knows that there's a very good possibility you're dealing with danger, and she would worry a lot. And you can't really talk about it very much. The other one, I think, is just the basic being apart. You know, long distance relationships don't last very long. And I think there's a third one as well. A fourth one is what you said. He says that we change.
Yeah.
And I think there's a fourth one that your job comes first.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody thinks that your family comes first.
Yeah.
Well, in the regiments is that even though they are family orientated, you know, when the bell rings, the job comes first. Mm. And I think your spouse knows that. And they know they don't come first on the list, is that the job come first. And it does, realistically.
And did you find yourself change personality? Did you become more selfish?
Yes. I think what it is, one of my mates put this very nicely. And he said, Des, we go away and we change. But when we come back, the family stay exactly the same,
of course,
don't they?
Of course.
He says, we go to that country, we go to Latin America, Africa, and what have you. And he says, we have great experiences, don't we?
Mm.
He says, that's one of the reasons, you know, we love the regiment. He says, it's just fantastic experiences what we have. So he says, that's bound to change us. He says, and when we come back, we're coming back to little old Hereford.
Yeah.
You know, and our families are there. And they've made their own life.
Yeah.
And he says, and we, in a way, can't wait to travel again and get another experience. Mm. So that could be the main one, you know, is that, yes, we definitely do change.
So in that 20-year period, tell me some of the countries you've been to.
Yes, I've been to a lot of countries. But as far as the ones that people know about conflict-wise, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Somalia, Bosnia, then clandestine operations. That's an old-fashioned term for kind of secret operations, isn't it, or whatever. They used to call them clandestines down in Africa, Latin America, Middle East. But saying that, I think a lot of people think about the regiment that we are in conflict all the time. And I know we do have a reputation of getting the job done. Yeah. So when the job has to get done, it has to get done. But a lot of the regiment's role is gathering of information.
Yeah.
So we may go to these countries, you know, in small groups, you know, in typical SF, and gather information within that country that, let's say, something volatile may be happening in the future. We bring that information back, it's collated, it's passed on, and we can see then if the other organizations can go there and maybe police it or do something. So it's not always full-on action, you know, and a lot of what the regiment do is clandestine, is quiet. We don't want to be seen. We don't want to be known. And so we are gatherers of information a lot of time. And I think a lot of people don't realize that. We think it's just get in there, you know, flashbang, get the job done. But when that has to be done, fine. It has to be done. But it's not like that all the time.
How many times, if you were to look back, how many times have you done jobs where you've gone in, flashbang, wallop, out?
Yes, I would say quite a few. it's quite a few, but I think,
are we talking 10, 20?
Yes, probably 20 plus. You know, some of them are short, some of them are long-winded. I think some of, let's say, things which have happened in, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan, which have happened over years, you can imagine that a lot of the jobs that you do are long-term, ongoing all the time. There may be something that comes up in a country that needs to be dealt with straight away, you know. So, but yes, you have these operations that go on for months and sometimes years, and there's others that can go on and that happen fairly quick. And you know, we have to be attended to straight away. And I think everyone looks at the regiment, if you like. It does have that reputation.
Well, that's the sexy bit. As a non-SAS man, how'd you get in there? How'd you do that drug deal?
That's it.
Back on the helicopter and you're off.
And in reality, I was talking to my mate the other day, and he says, in reality, Des, they don't realize that it's hard, hard work. You are cold. You are tired. You know, it's long hours. And a lot of the time, it may not turn out successful, you know. And a lot of the time, it's dangerous. You know, well, most of the time, it's like my mate said. He says, Des, he says, you know, when we went in the regiment, it said what it says on the can, isn't it? Yeah. You know it's going to be difficult. And on that one, Dodge, somebody was talking to me the other day about how kind of we're selected, or guys in the regiment that are selected. And I think it just simply put is that the selection process actually picks you.
Yeah.
The selection process went all the way back to the 1950s. And they said that if we have got certain soldiers and we are putting them in difficult, arduous situations, we need a certain type of individual. And it's only a selection process that will be able to do that. And they found that hard physical stress with hard mental stress mixed with sleep deprivation stress. Oof. You put those three together and it brings out the real you.
Yeah.
For example, the first day I turned up on selection, on both selections we could say, the instructors do a very stressful thing. On the first one, there was 275 guys. And on day one, they said to you, right guys, everyone look around at each other. So we were looking around. This is 275 guys. And they said to you, just to let you know, guys, within 4 or 5 weeks, there's going to be less than 40 guys left.
Wow.
Okay. After 6 months, there's going to be less than 10 guys left. And they tell you that on day one.
Wow.
And you know, they actually then said to you, by the way, guys, if you don't want to turn up and you don't like it, stay in bed. Make sure you pack your kit in and pack it away and come and see the boss before lunchtime, before you go. You don't have to turn up if you don't want to. And they do that purposely. And I remember the very next day, there were 5 guys that didn't turn up, you know. And you stood there all looking at each other and thinking, oh, you know. And you see these big guys and fit guys. And I can honestly say when I went through selection, there were guys bigger, stronger, faster, arguably better soldiers and what have you. But Dodge, you've got to be there at the end to pass.
Yeah,
you know.
Is there one country that stands out for you in the 20 years you've done that you're like, that is the toughest thing that I've ever been involved in?
I don't think I could pick out one. I think they're all different in certain ways. Iraq has always been a tough one. Afghanistan has. I went to, let me think, this is a strange one you might find. I went to Haiti some years ago.
Okay.
Yeah. Remember when they had the earthquake over there?
Yeah.
And
what year roughly are we talking?
Yes. In? Are we talking that was it 2008-ish? Yeah. I don't know. I'm just trying to think. And I remember going there and I went to, it's absolute chaos. You can imagine. And they had the 82nd Airborne there. They'd come in on a ship. They had a ship like a floating hospital, you know, and they had American troops there and what have you. And I remember going into a place called City Solaire. You know, this was an awful place, you know, and it was a typical, you'd go into a house and you'd have the pig running through your legs. You'd have guys that were on drugs and they were slapping women and what have you. And we were in there doing a certain operation and the Red Cross were there and what have you. And you could really feel it. These people did not like you.
Yeah.
You know, they were doing awful things. They would get you and they would pull your arms and legs off. And I can particularly remember being there at that time thinking, this is horrific. You know, they'd already had this earthquake. You know, you'd got people, I think it was 80% AIDS out there. You'd had, I think, 250,000 people had already been killed because of the earthquake. Oh. There were kids just walking about the street that had no parents and what have you. And this city was known for the criminal element running it. And to get in and out in it was very, very volatile. And we had some incidents there where it was particularly bad. And that's just one I can remember, which isn't the run-of-the-mill type countries that a lot of guys speak about.
Why were you there? And what incident, which was not a nice incident when you were there?
Yes, we were doing some protection work. Some people had to go in there and do a certain job. So we were there protecting them. And we went under guise of being another organization. Yeah. And what happened was, is that some of the individuals there started to turn on us and realize that we weren't who we said we were.
Yeah. Okay. Who did you say you were?
We were saying that we were part of an aid organization which we're helping out.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, and there were obviously other things that was going on. Yeah. People started to notice this. These people, just to set the scene, are on drugs. Yeah. They're hallucinating, you know, and they, as I said, they're just punching and hitting people and what have you. And an incident, you know, come about where it looked like they were starting to attack. And it got to a stage where we had to pull away in vehicles, and there were people actually hanging onto vehicles as we were driving away, you know. So it got very volatile. And I can particularly remember that, thinking, wow, you know, what an awful part of the world. And you had to feel for the people, the innocent people there, if you like, that are getting dragged up and pilled up in all of this. You have this criminal element which are going crazy.
Yeah.
You'd had this earthquake, and you'd had people that were just wanting to kidnap you and then sell you to organizations. It's just a world gone wrong, and it's very hard to kind of explain to people, Dodge, when you're in a situation like that, then you come back to normality. For example, I was in Iraq once, and there was a bomb went off, and 45 people were killed. Within 36 hours, I was back in UK. All of a sudden, I'm holding my two little toddler's hands, okay, at a market, eating a sandwich.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, my mind's kind of going back, and I'm thinking, all I could see was normality in front of me. Yeah. Everybody laughing, having a cup of tea, vendors making sandwiches, and my two little boys, I'm holding their hands, and we're having a chat away. And yet 36 hours later, you know, it was told to me that there were three generations killed within that bomb, you know. Jesus. And sometimes very hard, yeah, when people say, oh, and, you know, what you've been doing, sort of thing. It's no use even
you
talking.
You can't explain,
it's no use
can
even
you?
Talking yeah. about it. And, yeah. And what it says, it's just a going, oh, that's not nice. And you kind of just have to move on with it because, you know, a few days later, you're on another op, yeah, sort of thing.
That one in Haiti, I'm really intrigued about. Were you carrying then? Were you,
yes.
Were you carrying? Oh, okay.
Yes. Yes.
So did you feel that if anything kicked off, you could let fire, but if let fire, it would even go even worse?
Oh, yes.
Worse.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. You know, I mean, yes. You're trying your utmost to get the job done, yeah, without it turning loud, as we call it.
Yeah, okay.
You know? And so you're doing the very best you can, and obviously you don't want loss of life, you know. But there's a job that you've got to do, and you've just got crazy people that are wanting to do crazy things.
Have you ever been involved in any drug operations in England?
No, I haven't myself. No.
Okay.
No.
What about drug operations other countries?
We got involved some years ago, and this was public. In fact, the Prime Minister at the time, and actually said that the British SAS was getting involved in Colombia, okay, and what it was, America was involved, saying that you know, social standards were dropping in America, and it was all to do with drugs and what have you, and they were getting involved in the dealing with drugs or fighting the cartels out in Colombia. Mm. And it was well documented, and we thought it was quite surprised that the government decided to put it in the paper. Mm. Yes, we went out there, we were training the police and doing whatever we could to alleviate the drug problem. And it was quite farcical, because we're thinking, hang on, you know, nobody's supposed to know about this. And John Major come on the radio stroke TV and put it in the press, sort of thing. We thought, oh, okay, yeah, that's blown our cover.
Yeah. I wonder if John Major, by doing that, has actually given the SAS more kudos around the world.
Yes, it's I realize there's reasons behind it. You know, if they say, well, Britain are getting involved, you know, they feel it's a problem as well. And, you know, there were other countries involved and stuff. And, you know, there was a massive thing going on at that time anyhow, you know, it's quite a few years ago. And, but it was very public. And so a lot of the military organizations can now get involved in a lot of, can be seen as civilian problems, if you like, you know.
Have you seen a lot of cocaine in your life?
No, I haven't. I must admit, I haven't had much to do with the drugs itself, you know, and I haven't seen that, but I know I've worked with the Met Police, and you know, they say, you know, regarding drugs, with his weapons, his drugs, and obviously there's a big problem, you know, down in London and the likes. And I know they were talking about problems in Manchester. They were saying it's more to do with the weapon problem, more to do with the drug problem, because a drug problem, they can generally, you know, to a certain extent, get on top of it. But with weapons, people start to get hurt, you know, and die.
Tell me about your experience in Iraq. When was the toughest years for you out of your 20-year career in the SAS in Iraq?
Yes, it's...
and Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, that goes back to 1991. Yeah. Is we had the first Gulf War.
Yeah.
And what it was is that Saddam Hussein, who was the leader of Iraq at that time, decided that he wanted to invade Kuwait. And what it was then is that... it was an American-led. America said, nope, this can't happen. And Britain, America, and other coalition forces decided to get together in Saudi. And what happened was is that it was the first Gulf War of 1991. Saddam invaded Kuwait, I think it was around about September 90. They gave him, I think, up until January for him to leave. We knew that he wasn't going to leave. And so thousands and thousands of troops, okay, accumulated in Saudi Arabia, on Gulf War One.
Yeah.
And the regiment, the SAS, made it very clear that they were going to get involved in a big, big way, simply because that was 91. So 50 years earlier, they were fighting Rommel in the desert. In fact, it was the birth of the regiment in 1941 when... David Sterling and Paddy Main formed the regiment, if you like, of the SAS. Mm. And they saw the Gulf War won in 1991 as being, well, this is the same. This is our bread and butter. This is shoot and scoot, disruption, fighting with vehicles. And what it was is that the regiment made it clear that they were going to get involved in a big way. And we had three squadrons get involved. Two squadrons were ready to cross the border in Saudi and fight all the way up to Baghdad. And what happened was is that Saddam was very clever, started to fire mobile Scud missiles and fire them into neighboring countries, one of them being Israel.
Yeah.
And Israel was ready for coming into the war. And Britain and America said, please don't come in. We will find these Scud missiles and eliminate them. And that's how the Bravo patrols came about. I think most people have heard about Bravo 20.
Yeah.
Okay.
And your book, Bravo 30.
My book, Bravo 30. And I think my book explains about there were three patrols, Bravo 1, Bravo 2, and Bravo 30. And it told our stories of how we had to enter Iraq and try and find these needles in a haystack, which was these Scud missiles, which they were firing on to Israel. And so at that, I've written a book about that.
Yeah.
And it's, it explains the actual story of actually what happened.
And what did happen?
What happened was this, is that my squadron at the time, B squadron, we were only supposed to do one job, and that one job was battle casualty replacements.
Say that again.
Battle casualty replacements. Okay. What it was is that three squadrons, two of them being A squadron and D squadron, they were already trained up. They'd been training in the Middle East for quite some months. And they were battle ready, let's say. That's the terminology.
Yeah.
They were battle ready, okay, for crossing the border into Iraq. And in other words, taking on targets, okay, the Iraqi army and fighting all the way up to Baghdad. Wow. So they were ready.
Okay.
They had got their task and their mission, what they're going to do. We were there, just pure and simply, B squadron. We come in at the end, if you like, and our job was, anyone that was killed in any of those squadrons, we just changed. So it was a battle casualty replacement.
Yeah, okay.
So if someone died in one of the squadrons or injured, they would pull him back, rear echelon, and one of us would go and take that place.
Okay.
But it changed rapidly. What would happen was, is about the Scuds started firing into Israel, and they said, oh, we need to get patrols, okay, and fly them in there beyond the two squadrons.
I see, okay.
To find the Scuds, because if we don't, Israel's going to come into the war, okay, and then all of the Middle East, okay, will then unite against, even though they didn't agree with what Saddam had said, if Israel had come into the war, it would change.
Is that right? So all the countries, if Israel got involved, other countries would go against Israel. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. Yes.
Wow. Okay.
And so...
you guys were just like, Israel, stay back, let us deal with this.
Yes. So what happened was, is that there was just one patrol at first, which was Bravo 2-0.
Yeah.
And then they said, oh, we need another, Bravo 1-0. And then they said, tell you what, we need three patrols to go out. And we had Bravo 3-0. And what it was, they saw that from Baghdad, leading out to other countries, let's say up to Turkey, over to Syria, over to Jordan, they found that you've got MSRs, main supply routes.
Mm.
And they find that these were like arterial roads going straight through the desert. So they said, right, if we get three patrols, get a patrol on each one of these highways to have a look, maybe we may be able to see these Scuds being transported.
Yeah, okay.
Because these Scuds, they were like mobile rockets. There was like pulling. It was like a big articulated lorry with a rocket on the back.
Right, okay.
And they could drive down a freeway, stop at any time, raise it up and fire it, okay, into the neighboring country.
And how far do these go?
Yes, these could do, well, they would bring them into the desert, in the Iraqi desert, and they would fire them over to Jordan or Syria and mainly over to Israel. And I think these things can fly at Mach 2, Mach 3.
Wow.
And from firing to actually landing would take 3 to 4 minutes.
Wow.
You know, and it was our job to go and find them.
So do you think Saddam was trying to wind up Israel?
Yes.
To get them to fight, so everyone would go against Israel?
Correct, yeah.
Right,
and
okay.
He was very clever doing okay. that. Yeah, he just wanted to stir it all up. And, you know, even though he said, well, no, Kuwait belonged to me, you know, America and the rest of the world said, no, you can't do that. And we're coming in to show you that right. you can't. And what it was then is that the three patrols were flown in by two Chinooks, flown beyond. So we were the furthest patrols beyond. No one had gone over the border yet. Our two squadrons were waiting to cross the border, and we got the three patrols on two Chinook helicopters and flew us 200 miles just outside Baghdad, okay, and put us on the MSRs to actually look for these Scud rockets.
So they've dropped them. You in the mix,
right,
and then you've got to go and find the Scud missiles to stop this happening.
Correct. And just to kind of give you a feeling of, which is very similar now, is that all of a sudden, the tension changed, where we were just a fairly simple job, not a good job, but battle casualty replacements.
Yeah.
It's quite a simple job,
yeah.
really. Suddenly, it turned very complex. We weren't battle ready, okay, was one. Okay, we hadn't been out preparing out in the Middle East like the two squadrons had done, A and D squadron. And all of a sudden, they're asking us to do a very, very complex job. And we could see that it was becoming political as well. If Britain and America, firstly, Britain said to America, look, we want to get the SES in, and they go, yeah, okay, like, you know.
Yeah.
At that time, Schwarzkopf, who was the leader, wasn't very keen on the SES,
yeah.
but they managed to persuade him. He says, yes, okay. What it was, it became political by telling Israel, saying, well, look, Britain has got this covered. We've got three patrols to go in. We're going to sort this out. You don't, because there were talks about Israel had got 500 paratroopers on standby ready to jump into Baghdad. Well, that obviously would have changed everything.
Yeah.
But as you could see, three patrols tried to find as many, you know, they reckon there was about 45 of these rockets traveling all over the desert. Well, it's like trying to find a needle in a haystack.
Yeah.
So from us as soldiers, word were going around, very kind of dramatic statement saying this is going to be a one-way trip. You know, this is, you know, a suicide mission. And we kind of, you know, even though we laughed about it, we're thinking, well, this is not far off.
Yeah.
And then we're going, the chances of us finding these Scuds are quite remote. So we thought, you know, is this political? And then when people started to say, well, if we don't send these three patrols in, there's a very good chance of it starting World War III. And we're going, don't be so daft. But as you can see with what's happening with the, you know, situation at the moment in the world, is that at that time, we're going, Third World War could come about quite easily. So we could see in a way we were kind of being like, in, you know, political pawns, if you like. But we took the job seriously and we just says, okay, we've got to get on with this job. And I tell the story in the book how the three patrols ill-prepared, as you know, Bravo 2-0, you know, had, got into some real problems, a lot of it because, you know, we didn't have the preparation that, that we needed. I also tell in the book how Bravo 1-0 actually got out on the ground, realized there were problems and come back. I tell a story how we went out on the ground and actually had problems with radios. We didn't have the right signals equipment. We didn't have the right weapons, right ammunition. We didn't have the cold weather equipment because it turned out to be one of the coldest winters that Iraq had ever had.
Was it cold out there, was it?
Absolutely freezing.
Okay.
You can't predict the weather. That's fine. But you know, weapons and vehicles and clothing and ammunition and all that sort of things you can have control over.
Did you know at the time that this wasn't good enough, or is it only on reflection?
No, we knew at the time. What had happened? I suppose in conflict, what tends to happen is that there's a there's a chaotic flutter. And what I mean by that is that, right, we've got to get the guys over there. Let's get equipment over there. Right, we've got to prepare for this. We've got to have the, and a lot of the equipment itself doesn't reach the guys at the time it should do.
Right.
As I've already said, the two squadrons that were already out there, they'd already prepared. They'd already got equipment. They'd already done their training. Mm. They'd already knew what was coming. My squadron, B squadron, we wasn't going to go to the Gulf at the first. It changed at the last minute.
Okay.
And we wasn't prepared. And when we went out there, we find, obviously, there was a shortage of equipment because the two squadrons had it all, rightfully so. There's nothing wrong with that. But then when a complex task risen, like sending three patrols 200 miles behind enemy lines to do a very, very complex task, well, then obviously you need specialist equipment. And none of us were prepared. And especially then on top of that, the weather become terribly bad. And in fact, so bad that we had a guy that actually died with exposure.
He died with exposure?
Yes, yes. And he, so there were so many things that that went wrong out there. Bravo 2-0 had contact and had problems, and guys died and were killed.
How many people died in Bravo 2-0?
They had, I believe there was, I think it was three guys that died on that patrol. And then we had A squadron and D squadron. They had contacts and there was guys killed as well. We were lucky as far as that, even though we were the, we didn't realize we were the furthest patrol beyond anyone else. And we didn't realize this because we wasn't getting the actual information coming over the radio because we didn't have the right codes and the right frequencies. We, if you like, got on with the task, okay, and did the best we possibly could. We nearly got shot down going in on helicopters because a Top Gun pilot confused us for enemy and had a lock on and was firing rockets at us while we was on the ground. We had another Top Gun aircraft that actually dropped a bomb near us, and simply because they didn't know we were.
Jeez.
Simply mistaked us for the enemy.
How many men in your squadron, in your Bravo 3-0?
Yes, in each patrol there was eight men.
There's eight men?
Yes.
And you lost one?
No.
So you didn't lose any, but, but Bravo 2-0 lost three men.
Yes.
Bravo 1-0?
No, they come back.
They come back.
Yes, yeah.
So when you're, just so explain to you, I'm trying to get my head around this. You're landing in a chopper. You're there to do a job for how long?
Yes, we was out on the ground approximately 2 weeks. And but what was going to happen is that if the job was going to go on longer, we was going to be resupplied in the field. It's only there at the end we got compromised and one of our vehicles broke down. We had to extract ourselves and actually get out and actually come back to Saudi Arabia.
Bloody hell.
Yeah.
So can you signal for the chopper to come back and pick you up at any time? Or are you like, right, to get out of there, we've got to get in a car to get over the border?
yes, you can send signals, and there's certain procedures that you have to follow. And because of the problems with the radios and the frequencies, okay, and the locations and the problems we were having with the vehicles, it was accumulation of problems. Okay, we found that we couldn't marry up, if you like, with the frame, the helicopter, to get us back. And at the end, I say a story in the book is that when we all got together and we were in the squadron talking about this, we have a behind the doers kind of chat. In other words, it's chest poking, and we get the colonel and the boss and whatever, and guys actually, you know. And we said to the colonel at the end, you know, I think at one stage, Dodge, I think there was about 44 guys on the run at one stage in the regiment. Didn't know where they were behind, you know, in Iraq, you know, from, this is from B squadron, D squadron, and A squadron.
So they were in Iraq, but they didn't know where they were.
Correct, correct. So, and what
how,
happens-
how, I'm confused here. How do they not know where they are?
It's because what happens is that once there's a contact, let's say, with the enemy,
yeah,
and rounds go down and they disperse, okay, they're actually now on the run.
Right.
Okay, we're not sure where they are, and because of radios and the problems and the frequency, sometimes the radios are not instant radios. You can't get on the radio. Sometimes these are coded radios as well. So because of accumulation of problems, I believe there was about 40 odd guys on the run, and they actually said to the colonel is that, why did we not have helicopters come back and collect the guys? He goes, well, if we had 40 guys on the run, I wasn't going to get an helicopter with another 20 or 30 guys on. There's a very good chance we could have lost that as well. So the guy says, okay, maybe in future we need to have a more deeper understanding of whether you're going to send a rescue team or not. In other words, we're big guys. You know, we have a sandwich, big boy rules. We need to know the right information. And he said, yeah, you know, we get it. I suppose you have to look at it is that these difficult decisions have to be made in war, in conflicts, if you like. And it's a difficult time. Mm. Yeah.
Were you angry about that when you landed back?
The answer I think that we all put is that if it happened today, would you still do the same thing? And I think, yeah, it's because this is our job. This is what we do. We can't all of a sudden, Dodge, say, well, you know, we've got to have the perfect weather. It's too cold or whatever, you know.
But equipment and communication, surely
agreed
you must look back and go, hold on a minute.
Agreed.
Who sent us in with no communication and crap equipment?
Yeah. And for example, we took out two vehicles. And they turned up and they were just, they weren't battle ready. They weren't even painted. They were just two normal Land Rovers. You know, one was a long wheelbase one and one was a short base one. And we just had to adapt to them, you know.
Okay.
And I think I think that's the good thing about the regiment is that, okay, we're not always going to get things ideal. You just got to get on with a job. That's what it says on the can. You know, you're in the SAS. And you can't all of a sudden say, I don't like this situation. Yeah. I'm not going to do it. This is what you get paid for, and this is what you do. Agreed. And you know, some, I've been on other operations where things go wrong all the time. For a start, you can never guarantee the weather. That's one. I know that.
Yeah.
One guy in the regiment puts it very nicely, is that, Des, we can't guarantee a lot of things. But one thing we can guarantee is that things are not always going to go according to plan. And that's for sure.
Mm.
And I think it's, the testament to the guys, if you like. They're in difficult situations. Let's get on and get it done. The only problem with something that we talk about there with is lack of equipment or lack of information. Like, for example, the intelligence that we had wasn't correct, you know, when we talk about the ground and stuff. The only thing on that is that some guys paid the ultimate price for not having the proper equipment or not having the proper information. Mm. That's why Bravo 1-0 that came back actually made a very, very, gutsy call. He actually said, I haven't got the right information. This doesn't look right. I actually got the helicopter to move into a different position. I had a look again, got off the aircraft, said, this is not the right information I'm getting. This is the wrong intel. And actually brought his patrol back to camp. And actually, in my opinion, saved guys' lives.
Who's in charge of Bravo 1-0?
That was, yes, I can't think of his name at the moment, but
fair play to him for making that call.
He got a lot of flack.
Well, how were you he got a lot of flack.
He got a lot of flack for it. Well, you can imagine, well, you should have done this, you should have done that, you should have done the other.
But his argument is, I've saved 8 men.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
How were you feeling when you landed and knowing that the equipment's not right? You're freezing your plums off. It doesn't feel right. There's not a good vibe. What was going through your head?
Yeah, it's a strange thing. One thing you do, you start seeing the funny side of it. Right, okay. That's strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, you start having a bit of a giggle about it and a laugh about it. And you know what that is, Dodge? It's really tension, isn't it?
Yeah.
The guys are scared. You know, guys crack a joke. And it's a way of releasing tension. And everybody knows that. So everybody jumps on board with it. And, we're in a right pickle here, guys, aren't we? But what happens is you get your heads together and you go, right, yeah, this is not good. But... you know, we can deal with this. So let's just knuckle down. Let's just do what we've got to do. Mm. You know, and if we can't do it, well, let's, maybe we might be able to pull back, reorg, think about it again, and then come back another day. Mm. Do you know, one evening, I'm answering your question even further. We were in the vehicles. This is Bravo 3-0, and we could see bombing going off in Baghdad. And Baghdad was taking hell of a pounding. We could see it. And we could see the aircraft coming in, and we could see the bomb, and we could see Baghdad fighting back, you know, and we just sat there in the vehicles, you know, and nobody said a word, you know, we're just looking. And I remember the next evening, you know, we had a bit of a chin wagging saying, that was bad, weren't it? And they're going, yeah. And they go, look, we know things are bad here, but if we don't find these Scuds, or if we don't do something that could alleviate what's happening over in Baghdad, a lot of innocent people are going to die. So we had that, we would go, let's do the best we can. It might not be the actual mission that we set out to do, but simply because we've got restrictions of weapons and vehicles, and we could see problems with the radio, we couldn't pass on information, or garbled messages were getting through, let's just say that. But I tell you what, we all agreed, we said, let's do the best we can. And then when we do get back, you know, when we do get back to base, at least we can put our hands on his chest and say, we might not have achieved what we really wanted to do, but we've done the best that we've
fair
can.
Play.
And that was our kind of thinking, if you like.
Why did you go for the Scuds and not straight in to take Saddam Hussein out?
Yes, a lot of people have asked that. I think what it was, it was told to us that they wanted to keep the infrastructure of that country. They found out in the past that if they go in and they hit a country hard and the infrastructure is broken and they take the leader out and whatever, that country has to come in and take over the problems.
What
they did, they kept Saddam in place. They frightened him enough for him to pull out of Kuwait, you know, and they said, if you don't do this, this is what we're going to do, et cetera, et cetera. And they tend to have kept everything in place, the infrastructure, if you like. And so that was the reason of finding the Scud missiles. In other words, to get Saddam to go back to what he was doing before, because Saddam at the time had the largest army in the Middle East. He had over 1 million troops, and he'd been fighting Iran at the time.
Yeah.
So in a way, that was beneficial to the West, so to speak, that he was the big guy on the block. He could fight Iran, and he was doing everything that was asked of him. He'd gone over and invaded Kuwait. No one agreed with that. They said, right, if you pull out of Kuwait, you can go back to what you're doing, and that's why. We were told anyhow, that's why they didn't go in and kind of finishing it off altogether.
What were you wearing? What did you have on you? How much ammunition? What guns did you have on you? What protection did you have on you? Where were you sleeping?
Yeah. So the weapons that we had, you know, are basically a spin-off from the M16s, okay? And the equipment we had was quite minimum. What we were actually wearing to keep warm, we actually thought that the weather out in the desert was going to be quite warm. And it actually turned out to be one of the coldest on record. So we found we were wearing our MBC suits on top in any layer to kind of keep us warm, if you like. Because when you know it's going to be cold, guess what? The cold weather equipment comes out.
Yeah.
In other words, bigger jackets, you know, parkas, et cetera, gloves, hats. We had none of that.
Yeah.
So what we found we had to do, because it was going quite a bit with Lloyd's, that we found that we had to snuddle together, we had to get in sleeping bags together, Okay. We had to be careful not to touch metal on the vehicle because it would pull your skin off. We had to get as many layers on as we could. We have a system called hard routine where you don't cook and you don't drink hot drinks. We realized we had to stop that. We had to get warm drinks on. We had to get warm food in us because that is heat as well.
Yeah.
We had to shelter ourselves from the wind. It was a cutting wind. You can get a wind chill factor. Okay, so the temperature can come down. Let's say it can go, let's say, 5 or 10 degrees lower, and the wind chill factor can take it down another 5,
as you know. Yeah.
So a lot of it is common sense. One of the most important ones, Dodge, is actually watching each other. You've got to make the decision early. And making that decision early, warm food, warm drinks, clothing. If your mind goes foggy, you don't make common sense decisions. So you have to make that decision. So what we do, you do the buddy-buddy system. You pair up, like me, you would pair up. We would watch our orcs, you know, let's say, be on stag, sit in our sleeping bags. You know, you would get on a warm drink and go, there you go, Des. I would get on some food. We'd share it. We'd talk to each other quietly. Yeah. I would keep an eye on you. You would keep an eye on me. I would do so many hours sleeping. You would do so many stag on. We'd keep an eye on each other. A lot of that sounds very, very common sense. But when you're in a very hostile situation where people are coming to want to get you and maybe shoot at you and kill you, doing the most simplest things become very, very hard in an environment like that. So it sounds very simple. Doing it is very, very hard.
Wow. You know? I tell you what you needed back then. You needed a clothing brand called Through Dark. Yeah. Talking about jackets and warm and zip ups. They've got the lot.
Yeah.
Unbelievable clothing brand. Going back, 1991, when you finished that mission there, then you landed back, when was it, what year was it roughly, when someone said, go and take Saddam Hussein out of the equation?
Yes. Are you talking the second Gulf War?
Yeah.
Yes. It's the whole build-up to that was just strange, wasn't it? You know, and I know the regiment kind of got involved in that. And I've got to admit, I wasn't involved in that in a big way, Dodge. But it only lasted about a month or so, didn't it?
That's you know? Right.
What I was involved with is what I can talk about, is that I was actually out in the Middle East at that time. I was actually in Iraq. And Saddam Hussein was on the run, wasn't he?
Yep.
If you can remember at that time. And I remember I was with a media crew. Okay. And what they'd done, if you can remember, they found him in a hole.
That's
didn't
right.
They? You remember?
Yeah.
I was actually with the media crew that actually found him.
Is that right?
Correct. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And one of the guys actually got his flip flop, his shoe. Okay. Yeah. Because I know it sounds funny. And because what it was, he used to joke, I've got Saddam's flip-flop
quality.
Sort of thing. Yeah. And what had happened is that, again, not all the details, but they'd tracked him to this particular area. And then he'd been living in this particular area and they found him in like a hole in the ground, didn't they?
Yeah.
And of course, the media got onto it and whatever, and he eventually got captured, didn't he, sort of thing. And then he actually went to trial and went through a very long trial, didn't he? And actually went through all that ridiculous nonsense that went off. But that, what I was involved in on that side, not the actual, the Gulf War side of it. Yeah.
So that's funny, isn't it? He went on trial.
Yeah.
Surely someone has got to bang, take him out.
Yeah, well, there was this thing, weren't there, about that they should have done it properly, war trials over at The Hague and stuff like that. Can you remember all that?
Yeah, I do.
And because what it was is that I remember I was in Iraq at the time and they were going through the trial system, which I think was just going through the motions.
The motions, yeah.
Because right at the end, they handed him over to the bad guys, didn't they? You know,
and how did he die then?
Yeah, I don't know exactly, but I know he got handed over to the wrong or an organization, which actually, and he got hung, didn't he? You know, and it all ended wrong.
How would you explain him? How would you explain Saddam Hussein to the listener?
Yeah, I've talked with the Iraqi people out there and I've asked them the same thing, you know what, how do you see him? And a lot of them talked very favourable about him.
Yeah, right.
You know, they were saying that he was able to keep peace in that area. He knew about keeping war faction parties separate. He seemed to know quite a bit about politics. He seemed to know, you know, this area was sacred and to these people, and that wasn't sacred to them. He managed to keep order. Quite a few Iraqis used to say to me, if you didn't bother Saddam Hussein, he wouldn't bother you.
Yeah, okay.
He had a good infrastructure. There was always, I think it was Baghdad University, were always very well known for its, you know, being a great university, you know. And so when I used to ask the same question, most people used to speak highly on him. Wow. I suppose it's this thing about, it's the devil you know, isn't it?
Yes.
Is that if he keeps order, you know, and you know, you stick to the rules. They used to say you would have no bother with
yeah.
it. People say, well, why did, you know, that country, was it invading them? Well, there's always a larger picture, isn't there, which is probably beyond the scope of our talk today, like, you know. But yeah.
Where's your mate who's got the flip flop?
I don't know, we used to have jokes all about this, like, you know what I mean? And, you know, we used to hear about it. But it just shows you, one of the guys says, look at the height that he was at, where he ruled the Middle East.
Yeah.
You know, he was the big guy on the block with the biggest army. He had all the strength and all the power. And in the end, they found him in a hole in the ground. And
on the run.
Yes. And, you know, I suppose the tyrant will always get overcome at the end, you know. And, you know, we talk about the regiment like this, is that, you know, it can get a bit gooey sometimes, but I think you've got to feel you're on the right side. There's times you've got to pick sides, isn't there? And I know I'd be talking to people and, you know, why'd you do this sort of work and what have you? And you go, well, you've got to fight Tinnery.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to fight the bad guys. You've got to take a side. You've got to feel you're the guys in the white hat. Somebody's got to do it, you know? And I think when you're in the armed forces anyhow, you become very patriotic, don't you?
Yeah.
You become a royalist and, you know, and, you know, the link with, you know, the royals, if you like, and the governments and the army and even the church. It's always been linked together over the years, hasn't it? You know, and you can see as each of that institution erodes, you know, it seems to get worse and worse regarding tyranny, if you like, and the bad guys. I think the regiment's very good at going, hang on, you know, when something difficult needs to be done, well, we're here to do it. And it has to be done properly. Yeah. That's what I like about the regiment. It is done properly. It's done logically. It's done in a very linear fashion. And because, you know, here are some organizations doing this, doing that and the other. But if you do it wrong, you become no better than the bad guy, do you? You know, it's got to be done under the proper rulings, if you like.
When did you and why did you decide to leave the SAS?
Excuse me. I actually come to the end of my time.
Right, okay.
What it was is that the full term of service in the British Armed Forces, any armed forces, is 22 years.
Okay.
What they started to dodge is that they've started to do, if you want to, and if you, you know, if they think that you're capable of doing it, is the 2-year increments.
Okay.
I finished up all in all doing, I did 22, and then I did another 2 years.
Did you do
another? And then another two years
you?
Like that. But they offered it to me. They'll come up and say, right, there's a job that we'd like you to do in such and such a country. It might be a teaching job, you know, are you willing to do that? I go, oh yeah, that sounds good. Like, you know, we've got a job here in camp that we'd like you to, you know, to be the VIP protection. Can you teach this and whatever? So if it suits you and it suits them and there's a job availability, you go, yeah, why not? And I finished up doing, you know, once I was pensioned, 22 years, you can leave anytime you want. But then I finished up doing, you know, another 3 stints and of 2 years at a time. And I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
But once I come to the end, my last stint, I thought, that's it. I could just feel it.
Yeah.
Because when they offered it me, I go, yeah, I fancy another 2 years and then another 2 years. But once I did that last stint, I thought, do you know, I've had enough.
You know, it's like a professional sportsman, isn't it? Getting old on a minute. I'm feeling my way out. The time's right. And was that in your heart of hearts, you're like, my time's done now?
I think there's a shelf life, isn't there? Dodge, you know, I think you've got to know, you know, how good you are, how fast you are, how ugly you are. You know, there's a shelf life.
Yeah.
And sometimes you feel, you know, I've had enough of this. And I finished up from then going on to the circuit, and I finished up doing the old VIP stuff for celebrities, you know, for footballers.
Oh, really?
And, you know, and for, you know, some pop stars and what have you. And that was...
What sort of footballers? What sort of pop stars?
Yeah, I did Jamie Redknapp. He was a really nice guy.
Lovely
fella. And Jamie was captain at Spurs at that time. Yeah. And I got introduced to him and he says, oh, would you like to do some security for Spurs? Yeah. I did that at first. And then he says, oh, Des, I'm going to do this. Would you mind doing some security for me? So it was him. I did some security. Robbie Keane.
Yeah.
Okay, who was Spurs and Irish international.
It's actually
then.
Funny. Do you remember Robbie Keane used to score the goal, do the forward roll?
Yeah.
Your book, where can people find it? Number one is Bravo 3-0.
Yeah.
And the second part of the question is, were you nervous writing the book?
Yes. So the first answer to your first question is the best place to get it is on Amazon.
Yeah.
You know, and if you just go straight to Amazon and knock up, I did it with Damien Lewis, by the way. I believe you're going to have him on a podcast.
Yeah, he's on tomorrow. Either.
Brilliant. He's just a great guy.
Yeah.
Damien got in touch with me and said, look, I fancy doing a book with you. You know, do you fancy it? At first, I said no. But if people want a book, it's Des Powell, Damien Lewis, SES, Bravo 3-0, Amazon. Yeah. That's the easiest way.
Yeah.
When I first got approached, yes, I was very wary. I'd been living over in the Middle East. I'd been out in the UAE and I come back and I got approached, you know, do you fancy doing a book? And the first thing I said, no, I don't. I'm happy. You know, I'm living over there now. I've got a life and I just want to blend and just fade into the background now, you know, and that's a lovely place. I really enjoyed it. And, what was nice, I've got some good friends around me and they said, Des, I know you're not keen on the books and thinking about, you know, but this might be the time to do it. You're old enough, you know, you're ugly enough now. Why don't you just do this? I think you've got a story to tell. And it was my friends that persuaded me.
Yeah.
And I goes, you know, all right. And when I met Damien, I said, look, Damien, I'm concerned about this, concerned about that. He goes, yeah, no. He says, look, Des, one thing I promise you is this. He says, the story we'll write will be exactly as you tell it, man.
Brilliant.
He says, we won't slag anyone. He says, I promise you that. He says, give me strong opinions.
Yeah.
But he says, we won't slag anyone. Yeah. Are you okay with that? But he says, you know, I don't want to say that you got on with everybody. Yeah. You know, I goes, no, I want to have opinions of what you think, what went wrong. And, you know, I go, yeah. And he says, lastly, Des, he says, we don't speak ill of the dead. And I goes, yes. I says, okay. I says, that's done it for me. And
so Damien has said that, has he?
Yeah, that's what he said to me. And I think it was that that swung me.
Yeah.
Because I've seen some books, and I've actually told some guys, Dodge, that have said to me, I regret that, Des.
Okay.
I go, what do you mean? And one guy said to me, he says, well, I know I've said something in the book I regret.
Yeah.
He says, Des, he says, if me and you have an argument today, tomorrow I can come to you and apologize.
Yeah.
Once in the book, I can't do it.
Yeah.
I goes, yeah, I've got you, like. He says, no. And he says, you know, he says, you feel mad today. He says, a few months down the line, you're not.
Yeah.
And he says, I regret some things that I said, but he says, you've got to live with it. So he, I get that. So I was wary on all them fronts, but Damien did a sterling job. It became a bestseller.
Yeah.
And really pleased. And on that one, Damien's doing really well with his books now. He's you know, he's doing stuff about Sterling and Paddy Mayne.
Yeah.
He's talking about doing other stories with me in the future.
Yeah.
And on that one, Bravo 3-0, we've actually had some producers show interest in it regarding film and what have you. You know, okay, they've showed interest. It doesn't mean to say they're going to do anything. But, you know, when I look back, what I said to you earlier on, when I look back at that young guy at 15 when he left Skyle that couldn't read and write, and then it's funny, everything I've said that, you know, why don't you join the army? No, why don't you join Paris? No, I don't fancy that. Why don't you join the SAS? No, I don't think I'm going to do that.
Don't want to do
a
book.
Yeah, I don't want to do a book. And I've got to be careful what...
Well, I've got to say, I'm very happy to have you on the podcast today.
Well, do you know something? That's been great, Dodge. Thanks very much for having me. And I really do appreciate you asking me.
You're a proper gentleman.
Oh,
you're a real kind-hearted human being, and being here today, just sitting here for an hour and 45, hour and 50 minutes.
Wow, has it been
that
long?
It's been an hour and 50. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Do you know,
just to hear your story, like, what an eventful life.
Yeah.
From start to finish, and you've told the story unbelievably well, and I really appreciate you coming all the way down and sitting here for a couple of hours.
Well, do you know, so let me just thank you very much for inviting me. We've had a good day today.
We have,
And do you know, quite a few listeners actually get in touch with me from some of the podcasts that I do. And I just like to say, I can't get back to everybody. It's impossible, isn't it? But I read them all. And, you know, they say some really good stuff. And, you know, they actually support me. So it's nice like this that I'm able to say that. And I know you've got a really good thing going here with Eventful Life. So once again, thanks for inviting me.
You're a gentleman.
Today. Thank you, mate.
Good man, Des.
All the best, mate.
Nice one.
Cheers, mate.
Cheers,
thanks.
Mate.
Cheers.
Hi, guys. I really hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Can you do us a favour and leave us a review, as it massively helps us grow the show? Cheers, guys.